Let Freedom Ring, a special edition of Another View from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation.
In 1776, the year of our nation's independence, a group of enslaved men and women secretly founded a church in Williamsburg, Virginia. 240 years later, the First Baptist Church remains a symbol of faith, struggle, and perseverance. I'm Lisa Godley, filling in for Barbara Ham Lee, welcoming you to a special edition of Another View. Today's program, Let Freedom Ring, is a simulcast coming to you on 89.5 WHRV-FM and as a webcast from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation at letfreedomringchallenge.org. Churches, synagogues, and mosques have been gathering places where people of faith share common bonds, the desire to do good work, to improve their lives, and to help others. Over the next hour, we'll explore these bonds and the role of religion in freedom movements. We'll share how the First Baptist Church has been a part of the struggle for freedom and how a partnership with Colonial Williamsburg Foundation has brought new life to a long silent part of the church's history. I hope you'll join this conversation about the role of religion in freedom movements. Please call 1-800-595-7012 or tweet us at CWF Learn using the hashtag Let Freedom Ring Challenge. We'll introduce our panel and get your comments in a few minutes. But first, let's learn about the beginning of First Baptist Church, one of the oldest African-American houses of worship in the United States.
Sit down, down, sit down. Sit down and take your rest.
The seed that would become the First Baptist Church of Williamsburg was planted at the start of the American Revolution. A courageous group of enslaved and free blacks defied the law to gather for evangelical worship with an itinerant black preacher named Moses. They met in secrecy on the wooded acres of Green Spring Plantation, 5 miles from the capital city. Succeeding Moses as the head of the church was an enslaved man belonging to James Vobe, the owner of King's Arms Tavern. His name was Gowan Pamphlet. By 1781, the church had relocated to Raccoon Chase on the outskirts of Williamsburg, with Pamphlet as their spiritual leader. It was here in the early 1800s that a white townsman, a member of the Cole family, was moved by the heartfelt praise and singing he overheard. Cole offered the use of his carriage house on Nassau Street in Williamsburg to the congregation to have and to hold as long as it was used for a church. Despite Virginia's 1786 statute for religious freedom, Virginia law forbids slaves to meet in groups for any purpose without permission. Nevertheless, Pamphlet's congregation emerges from the shadows to meet unmolested on Nassau Street. To empower his church, Pamphlet petitioned for its admission into the regional Dover Baptist Association in 1791. The white-dominated organization accepted the Black Baptist Church of Williamsburg into its fold in 1793.
Before we continue, I'd like to introduce today's guest. Joining me are Reverend Reginald Davis, pastor of the First Baptist Church in Williamsburg, Linda Rowe, a historian with the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, Aman Amar Amanet of the Islamic Center of Virginia, Rabbi David Katz of Temple Bethel, Reverend Max Blalox of the Wesley Foundation at William & Mary, and Reverend Christopher Epperson, rector of Bruton Parish Church. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Reverend Davis, your church is one of our nation's oldest African-American churches. Could you please share how you think religion affected the enslaved people who founded First Baptist Church?
Well, I think that religion played a key role in the African-American life of the congregation, is because in the context of oppression, when you have inhumanity, then religion plays a role in keeping divinity and humanity together. So I see them coming together to appeal to a God outside of their social context in order to help them to deal and cope with the situation that they were in. So religion played a big part in helping to keep, as we would say, body and soul together.
Okay, we already have a tweet. Nathan wants to know of our panel, what should you do if your faith and the situation, and the Constitution, I should say, are at odds? What should you do? Iman, would you like to start?
Yeah, I think that we tend to understand the Constitution as simply a document that was written in 1787, and the ink is dried, it's fixed, and it's actually supposed to be a living document, and we have evolved in our understanding of the document. And so it's based on universal principles of human rights and dignity, and there are parts of the Constitution that when they were written already contradicted those fundamental, basic, universal principles. And we have hopefully gone beyond following the letter of some aspects of the Constitution. And we still have to keep pushing forward our understanding of principles. And so I think that our religious principles also should be universal divine principles that cause us to move forward, not to hold on always to the letter of laws that may not any longer provide the same benefit to humanity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike. Reverend Blaylock?
Yes, I think when we talk about our faith and the Constitution, that we're talking oftentimes about how we view text, the text of the Constitution, like you were just sharing, and our sacred text. And oftentimes the question becomes about the Constitution, which we'll be discussing some of this. Built into the fabric of the Constitution was that African American slaves were not an entire person. Mm-hmm. And our faith definitely calls, obviously all of us nodding, that our faith definitely calls us to say, no, that's not right. So we have to see, does the way we engage the Constitution, the way we engage our text, the way we engage our faith, help us to see everyone as whole and everyone as equal and everyone as a child of God?
Okay, thank you. Rabbi Katz, I see you nodding.
Yeah, no, in the same way, the reality of all of our religions is that they're living, our sacred texts are living documents, our religious lives are living organisms, essentially, and we also have to take those same principles and make sure that they are coming through and that we're able to find those universal principles inside of or through whatever is actually written down. So all of these sacred texts, both the Constitution, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, they're all living documents, and it is the relationship between us, between the community and the texts themselves, that's where we truly live.
But in some sense, the deeper truth found in all of those texts comes from our dynamic relationship with those texts and the living with them and the working through them.
Right. Yeah. And I think, too, on the heels of celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King, he was basically challenging America to make sure your creeds and your deeds match up. Mm-hmm. He said in one of his last speech, all we ask is that you be true to what you put on paper. And so again, you can have a document, but that document must be practiced because there's a difference in what you espouse and what you practice. And so King was saying, let creed and deed come together.
Exactly.
Okay. We have a tweet from E. Clarity who wants to know, why did enslaved people have to meet in secret?
I think I could answer that. In the period of the 18th century in Virginia and other colonies and the early states, there were laws against enslaved people more than five, say, in Virginia, meeting without permission.
Yes.
This was thought to be a safeguard for the larger society, and religious meetings became swept up in that, with the added feature of being the religion itself being suspect. Was it fomenting rebellion? Was it giving people ideas that would make them rebel against their condition or think of themselves with pride, which, well, they should have. But those kinds of meetings were against the law.
Okay, Reverend David.
Well, again, the oppressors had to make sure that the religion that was being practiced was not subversive. And so when you have the Nat Turner rebellion. That was one reason why they wanted to make sure that they really watched to see what the slave preachers were telling the slaves, because again, religion can either tilt toward maintaining the present situation, or it can tilt toward transforming it. And so if you want to maintain slavery, you got to make sure that the indoctrination of that particular religion would justify the social institutions at the time. And so Nat Turner was one reason why they really had to have people, black and white, to make sure that they, what they said to the slaves would not incite an insurrection.
Thank you, Reverend Davis. This is Let Freedom Ring, a special edition of Another View, coming to you from the studios of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. I'm Lisa Godley. Have your beliefs inspired you to work for those less well-off than yourself? Has your synagogue, mosque, or church been involved in efforts to improve race relations? Please share your experiences by calling 1-800-595-7012 or tweet us at CWFLearn using the hashtag LetFreedomRingChallenge. We'll continue our discussion about religion and freedom movements in just a few moments, but first, we'll continue with the history of the First Baptist Church and see how a slave uprising led to the church closing its doors for a year.
By 1830, the African Baptist Church in Williamsburg, as it was then known, claimed over 600 members led by Reverend John Dipper. Dipper was born into slavery in 1778, but would become a master bootmaker with real estate and business interests, which allowed him to purchase freedom for himself and his family. Reverend Dipper's gifts in the way of exhortation and preaching soon found him ministering not just before the Williamsburg congregation, but in the region roundabout. But Dipper's liberty to preach the gospel wherever he saw a need would be short-lived. In August of 1831, an enslaved preacher named Nat Turner led an uprising of slaves in Southampton County, Virginia, killing dozens of whites. In the aftermath of Turner's rebellion, the meeting house on Nassau Street was closed for a year. In time, Virginia law specified that black church services could not be held without a white person present. The increased scrutiny of his church prompted Reverend Dipper to leave town. Unable to settle his affairs, he left behind real estate, slaves, and debts owed to him.
You're enjoying this special edition of Another View, Let Freedom Ring. Whether you're listening to us on WHRV-FM, watching the webcast online, or following us on social media, we encourage your participation. What involvement did your place of worship have in the abolition movement? Please tweet your questions and comments or call 1-800-595-7012. I'd like to ask Linda Rowe, our historian about Colonial Williamsburg, the foundation, to give us some perspective about the role various communities of faith had in the effort to end slavery.
I suppose the most well-known is the Society of Friends, better known as the Quakers, commonly known. Although Quakers owned slaves in the early part of the 18th century, by the time of the Revolution, they were taking a stand against slavery, treated enslaved people with dignity, offered education, but also the evangelical faiths, Baptists, Presbyterians, yes. Methodists, reached out to enslaved people, free blacks, communicating that all people are equally in need of redemption, and some encouraged their membership to divest themselves of their slaves.
Yes. And a lot of people bought slaves, as you said, to treat them humanely,
yes.
To teach them. They had to do that in order that they could start teaching them about their humanity and about where they come from. And if you do that enough, then people will begin to feel uncomfortable about their situation. And this is one reason why a lot of the slave masters did not want the slaves to be educated, because as Frederick Douglass, as he began to learn the alphabet, and the slave master's wife was very, very proud of him. But the slave master said, no, don't do that, because once you educate them, they become uncomfortable with their situation. And so Frederick Douglass found a linkage between education and liberation. So that's one reason why that was a move against teaching the slaves.
We have Mike in Williamsburg calling in with a question. Mike, go ahead with your question.
Thought about the role of religion, whether it overall has been a net benefit or a net negative in freedom movements, not only in the United States, but as we see radicalized religions all over the world cause lots of harm. And I'm wondering how they feel about the place of religion, whether there's a net benefit or a net loss.
I see a lot of people shaking their heads. Who wants to jump in first?
I'll give it a shot. I think it's definitely mixed. I don't think that we can ever always say, especially with us looking at the history of our country, we've done a wonderful job of discussing some of the role religion has played within freedom movements here in our country, but we also have to remember that religion was playing a very strong role in trying to maintain the status quo.
Yes.
Like we have talked about. One of my favorite quotes is from about religion is from a singer, Ani DeFranco. She says, "Every tool is a weapon if you hold it right." Mm-hmm. And religion is a wonderful tool for encouraging people, for helping us to see our humanity in one another. It can also be warped to be a tool that says to slaves, "You are in your rightful place," and
Absolutely.
Says to everybody else,
Absolutely.
"You are in your rightful place, and this is the way God has ordained it."
Yes.
So we always need, I think the key is that within our religions, at least within the, I'm not sure about Islam, but Islam uses the same, we need prophets.
Yes.
We need people to tell us, to help us when we've turned in the wrong direction, to help right our way.
Okay. I think it's very complicated, though. We have to keep in mind that religion, faith, spirituality, however you want to characterize it, is but one voice among many in any given scenario, situation, historical context. And so often we will point to a particular act, action, series of events and say, here is religion in the midst of it. Where oftentimes religion is in the mix, but we're ignoring the economics of the situation,
yes.
We're ignoring the politics of the situation, and all of those other voices that are always competing for our attention and shaping the context
yes.
in which we live.
And I totally concur with that because if you go back, as I think back on slavery and how religion was used, how they would particularly go into the canon or the Bible, and pick out certain things to legitimate and justify. If you go back to Leviticus, they couldn't use Leviticus in the context of American slavery because Leviticus says 49 plus 1 year, you have to let all your slaves go, all debt is the year of Jubilee. So they couldn't use that because in one generation, slavery would be over. But they said, well, let's look at the Pauline's letters. So Pauline letter says, all slaves be obedient to your masters. And so they would use that text invariably to teach the oppressed that this is your lot, you're supposed to be like this. And so it's how you use, going back to your analogies, how you use religion.
Right.
And it's also remembering that all of these perspectives are usually available
yes.
within all of our traditions.
Absolutely.
You can find the good and the bad.
Absolutely.
So if it's a tool and it's how we're holding the tool, one of the great things that religion does do for us is that it offers us some of the best articulations of our higher purpose. It gives us the things that we aspire to.
Exactly.
And we have to sift through and find the pieces of text, the traditions that are meaningful, that can create meaning, and that can make the world a better place, and use those at the same time to educate people why these other things that if you adhere to them can end up being the lead to the negative
exactly.
That the caller was talking about. It's about how you hold the tool and which parts of it you really put into practice.
Exactly.
Yeah. Iman, you look like you were getting ready to, or you wanted to add something.
Well, yeah, I wanted to go back to the foundation of the United States and the idea of the Constitution. It was part of an evolution from the Middle Age concept of religion as this powerful institution that kept people in its place to an enlightened version where each individual was endowed with, by their creator, with natural rights or universal rights. And those thinkers before the revolution, Enlightenment thinkers were inspired by Islamic texts and thinkers, as well as European thinkers, and giving people a concept that as an individual, you chose your obedience to God and you had a natural dignity, and the government was something chosen by people and responsible to people, and it was based on a universal concept of human rights. Mm-hmm. And I think that we gradually started embracing that over centuries and leaving behind that medieval concept of everyone obeying their station in life and remaining there. And so there was a broad range of sources that brought us to what we understand of America and in our human rights today, which come from a broad range of traditions.
Right.
Okay. What role do you think communities of faith have had in freedom movements? Has your religion motivated you to improve your community? There is still time for your questions and comments, and we encourage you to call right now, dial 1-800-595-7012, or tweet us at CWFLearn using the hashtag LetFreedomRingChallenge. As we have seen, the First Baptist Church faced increased scrutiny during the turbulent years leading to the Civil War. The war and its aftermath brought even more challenges.
The American Civil War brought unprecedented loss and upheaval to the country. In the spring of 1862, the church was confiscated by the Confederacy to serve as a hospital for rebel troops injured while fighting in the Battle of Williamsburg. When the Union Army prevailed and the Confederates retreated, the building was reclaimed by the African Baptist Church. In 1863, the church officially changed its name to First Baptist Church of Williamsburg. Following the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, abolitionists from the Freedmen's Association in Philadelphia gained permission to open a school at the church to help former slaves acquire the education that had so long been denied to them. The Emancipation Proclamation freed slaves in rebel territories during the war. But it was the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, passed after the war ended, that finally abolished slavery throughout the land. The 14th Amendment guaranteed citizenship and equal protection under the law. And the 15th Amendment granted African American men the right to vote. Members of First Baptist Church were quick to take advantage of their newly recognized rights by voting and by running for public office. This included the church's young minister, John Dawson. At various times during his 46 years in the pulpit, Dawson served as treasurer of the city of Williamsburg, member of the Common Council, and a member of the Virginia Senate.
Efforts to overcome the legacy of slavery and discrimination continue to this day. This is a very complex and often emotional subject that no single program can completely cover. Hopefully, this discussion will encourage you to engage others and explore the important contributions communities of faith have had on our history. Phone lines are open. Call us at 1-800-595-7012 or send us a tweet right now. Reverend Davis, when you look back at the history of your church, how important was it to the community right here in Williamsburg?
Very much important. What it says is that in spite of the inhumanity, in spite of all the restrictions and the discrimination and oppression, that for 240 years we survived and we thrived. And that says something about a people, that when you really have God on your side, and this is where I see religion really coming together, because when no one else comes to your aid, at least you can feel that you can appeal to something outside of yourselves. And that's where a lot of the spiritual came. It gives people split moments of transcendence to be able to cope with their present reality. So I think it says something that about the resilience of a people, that they are God's people, and how regardless of how oppression tried to wipe them out, somehow through the grace of God, they were able to thrive and survive.
Okay, we have a tweet next from Inkwell. How has Islam and Christianity influenced and justified the enslavement of black people, and how do they keep it so? Wow. Jump right in there.
Okay.
Imam, go ahead.
Well, Islam is a religion which has, you know, specific laws that govern different areas of life. And so every individual had basic fundamental human rights, and they had legal recourse for any situation. So inside of the Islamic religion are protections for every human right. So
yes.
A person who was captive, which is the origin of slavery, where people who were captive in times of war had the right to earn their freedom, and that would be written, and they would work for their freedom. And if the master had a child by a slave woman, that child was free and was the heir to the master. So there was no concept of a permanent bondage of a whole people based on race. And so that's something that unique that happened in a point of history that's, I think, outside of any religious tradition. But it's something that happened here, especially in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Davis?
And I think that when you look at religion, Christianity, Islam, and its particular laws, I look at it from a cultural standpoint. Because first, you have to develop culture. But you need some to legitimate and justify that culture.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what I ask people is that, okay, this is your cultural practice. But God didn't put that culture together. You put that culture together. And you arrange people in a hierarchy. So you decide who's going to be on the top and who's going to be on the bottom. And once you get those structures together, then that's when you give what Peter Berger calls an ontological status, in that let people forget that it was human hands behind all of this and interpret it in such a way that if you act in accordance with this, you're actually acting in accordance with the will of God. If you go against it, you're acting in against the will of God. So I have to look at the cultural component in bringing these things together and keeping people oppressed. You have to look at culture, and you have to look at religion coming together in order to justify that.
Thank you. Here in America, many people of color embraced Islam because they saw that rather than finding their faith within a structure controlled by others, that was their own culture and within their own frame of interpretation,
right,
not under control of anyone else.
And that's why you have that here, because if you look at Christianity, the way it was interpreted to the slaves tended to degrade him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, if you go back to the Hermetic theory, that we are slaves because of something that Ham did, and therefore that legitimates and justifies slavery. So the way Christianity was interpreted to the slaves tended to degrade them. So they were looking for another venue that would support their humanity rather than degrade it.
And I think communities of faith have also provided a context for conversation.
Yes.
And well-meaning people of faith have been able to reflect upon the culture.
Yes.
And to reflect upon their spiritual tradition, their religious tradition, their texts, their laws, and call the present and prevailing order into question.
Yes.
One of the interesting vignettes that I've discovered being at Bruton Parish about the history of Bruton Parish is that in the Dover Baptist Association, there was a time when there was some controversy around baptism, and baptism came to a halt in the Baptist Church. And the rector of Bruton Parish, Mr. Hodges, started baptizing African-American children in the Baptist fashion.
Right.
And one of the changes I think that brought about in this community had to do with recognizing what baptism is in our tradition, bringing people into relationship with God.
Right.
And you can only bring people into relationship with God for so long and still enslave them.
Right.
So the change didn't happen overnight,
exactly.
But it created a framework where people started thinking about what they were doing, saying, and believing,
right,
and eventually created change.
Exactly.
Thank you, Reverend Eckerson. Did you want to add something?
Well, I think you're just thinking in context of baptism and in context of religion in these contexts is that, you know, part of baptism is not only bringing people into relationship with God, but is bringing people into relationship with the rest of the community.
Yes.
And that, you know, and that it's hard to say, I baptize you as a brother, as a sister in Christ, and then leave you enslaved.
Yes.
Or leave you as less than.
Right.
And I think about in our discussion what Abraham Lincoln said, that, you know, my concern is not am I on, you know, is God on our side,
right,
but am I on God's side?
There you go.
And I think that's the question for us when our religions or any religion is saying that somebody is less than,
yes,
or this structure is ordained by God to oppress others.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty good sign. We're not aligned with God on that one.
And it returns us to the fact that on some level, the most important thing religion does is create community.
Yes.
Right, and create the, and provide a shared, a shared structure, a shared foundation for community. Mm-hmm. And you can't have a community of inequality and have a community that's going to be meaningful or long-lasting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
I wanted to mention, too, the combination of church and state dating from the colonial period in this country. There's a danger in that. The church is part of the state. It gets much of its legitimacy from the state. And the state is in the business of keeping society orderly. And so, taking off from what you said, I think that means that it perpetuates this hierarchy where some people are low or very low,
right,
and others fill medium positions. So that combination of the church and the state is something that needed to come to an end, and it did through a process, though.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you, Linda. I hope you are enjoying this special edition of Another View, coming to you from the studios of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. Are communities of faith doing enough to improve race relations? Please share your experiences by calling 1-800-595-7012 or tweet us at CWFLearn using the hashtag LetFreedomRingChallenge. Before we continue taking more calls, let's learn about the First Baptist Church during the Civil Rights era.
In 1926, Reverend W.A.R. Goodwin, rector of historic Bruton Parish Church, realized his lifelong dream to restore Virginia's colonial capital when John D. Rockefeller, Jr. agreed to provide the financial means. The Williamsburg Holding Company began purchasing properties in the town center to proceed with the restoration. Many families, both black and white, were bought out and relocated. In the early 1940s, the benefit of keeping the church doors open 7 days a week to welcome tourists was advocated by Reverend R.E. Lee. Since the church was only one block away from the colonial restoration, sharing the proud history of First Baptist Church's 18th century beginnings seemed appropriate. The restoration continued to expand. In 1954, the Williamsburg Holding Company, as Colonial Williamsburg was then known, purchased the historic property on Nassau Street for $130,000 and a clear deed to land on Scotland Street, where a new church was built. In the 18th century, Gowan Pamphlet sought recognition and acceptance for his church through membership in the Dover Baptist Association, securing for his congregation the same fraternity enjoyed by their white Baptist brethren. Continuing Pamphlet's tradition, in the 1960s, Reverend David Collins championed equality and civil rights for African Americans through his work with the Virginia Christian Leadership Conference. Due to Reverend Collins' connections and influence as the Tidewater Vice President of that organization, he was able to arrange a Williamsburg visit by the recognized leader of the civil rights movement. On June 26, 1962, Dr. Martin Luther King addressed an overflowing crowd eager for social change from the pulpit of First Baptist Church. The connection between First Baptist Church and the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation continues. The story of the founding of the church is presented in an exhibit near the original site of the Carriage House on Nassau Street. In commemoration of the church's 240th anniversary, the long silent church bell, purchased in 1886, has been restored to working condition by Colonial Williamsburg, and is the centerpiece of 2016's national challenge, Let Freedom Ring.
From slavery through the Civil War, emancipation, the introduction of Jim Crow laws, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, to racial tensions still lingering today, the First Baptist Church has faced many challenges over time. During the Civil Rights era, many communities of faith joined efforts to overcome discrimination. Reverend Davis, how did your church work with other communities and other congregations during the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, we have always done our best as a congregation to push for civil rights. It was Reverend Collins, who was over the Tidewater Baptist Association, I believe, instrumental in bringing Dr. Martin Luther King to First Baptist Church in 1962. And Dr. King came to encourage the struggle in helping to bring about that civil rights and equal opportunity under the law. So First Baptist has reached out, been part of the march, and we'll continue to be part of struggling for what is right and for what is just, and make it as a more perfect union.
Okay. Anyone else want to add what their church or mosque or synagogue was doing during the civil rights movement?
We just returned with the Wesley Foundation from a week in Birmingham focused on civil rights and faith, and just seeing the role that the church has played within the civil rights movement in Birmingham, how many churches were involved in that. Predominantly African-American churches, but there were at least 60 within the association in Birmingham. And one of the things that, with us talking about transformation and the goal of religion, is that when the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was literally outlawed in Alabama, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth started another organization that was entitled the Alabama Committee for Human Rights. And it was human rights. Mm-hmm. It wasn't civil rights. And one of the things that we looked at, that for everybody who was joining in the movement, they had to be trained in nonviolence, and they had the Ten Commandments of nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And those commandments were based upon, the first commandment, I will meditate on the life and teachings of Jesus.
Yes.
I will work for the freedom of all people. It was always everybody. It was always faith guiding it. So that we've had those churches setting the example, and those religion, and the synagogues and the mosques joining together. We had many churches that didn't. So it's always been that mixed bag. But the push, thank God, that the push among those minority of groups and churches and people were able to take our entire country to a much better place.
Yes.
Jewish community also was very involved with the civil rights movement, and well, you're welcome. But there are so many historical places in which Jews were very involved. One of the earliest chairmen of the board of the NAACP was Jewish, and he got several very important American Jews to participate, leading rabbis. There's an anecdote that one black leader said that in the state of Mississippi in the 60s, like 90% of the civil rights lawyers were Jewish, mm-hmm. in the state throughout the whole decade. But for me, it brings out that kind of what we were talking about before, pulling out the values that are transcendent, the values that help that teach us what to aspire to, the Jewish tradition, the Jewish community, and throughout the civil rights era has said, justice.
Right.
We have the line, justice, justice, you shall pursue. And we have said that justice is so important that we need to make sure that we are telling people that we are serving as examples of fighting for justice for our fellows. Also, obviously, the story of the Exodus,
absolutely.
Which is the foundational story of the Jewish people, teaches us to help out anyone who is enslaved, anyone who's not experienced
exactly.
living in freedom.
Exactly.
And both of those are values that that became activist values back then, and that we try to make sure that we're espousing, that we're making a part of life today, and that we remember that in all settings, in all situations.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Imam, you were getting ready to say something.
Yes, and in the Muslim community, in the South, people don't realize that in the 18th and 19th century, African communities in the South had their own mosques from time to time in their own communities, but those were suppressed. And so in the early 20th century, thousands and thousands of African Americans left the South and left behind segregation and went north to the major industrial cities. And they came in contact with Muslim communities from the Middle East and Europe and Asia. And they formed their own movement, which was a civil rights movement, mm-hmm. to bring dignity back to their people. And so they used Islam as the symbol for their freedom and dignity as human beings. And so very important, of course, leaders of the civil rights movement like Malcolm X came from that movement.
Right.
And these are people who went through huge oppression that we can't even imagine, growing up and seeing the KKK burning cross on your right. your lawn and killing your people. And by Malcolm X, for example, going on the pilgrimage to Mecca and seeing people of every race together worshiping and living together.
Exactly.
He was inspired to leave that hate behind.
Yes.
And that desire for vengeance and move to a different level. Unfortunately, he was assassinated in 1965. But right. he evolved gradually in his understanding so he could embrace all of humanity with a mutual love of justice and freedom. And I find him one of the most inspiring people of the civil rights movement.
Exactly.
Right.
And also that the when you look at the slaves, they appeal more to the Old Testament because it really showed God moving in the life of oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And so they could identify with that. They could identify with the fiery furnace. They could identify with Daniel and Moses. Mm-hmm. So they saw themselves in like fashion that God was operating in and through that time to bring them to a place where the Jewish people were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a call, Elena in Norfolk. Elena, go ahead with your question or comment.
Oh, thank you very much. This is an excellent program. The comment is that at some point it appears that we only were informed of the abolitionist Christian connection, and there seems to be amnesia about the role of Christianity and somewhat evangelical Christianity in perpetuating and promoting slavery and that whole concept. I'm saddened by what I see as a focus on personal sexual immorality versus understanding the communal responsibility to do justice. And I'd like maybe a comment from each of your panelists on that. How is it that we could assist in moving us back to not only maybe me and Jesus, as it is sometimes put, but that love your neighbor as yourself piece of it? Somehow that seems to have been relegated to the back burner or ignored altogether.
Exactly.
Okay, what we said earlier was that we do know that religion is a tool in the hands of people. We just got to make sure that we handle it right. When I was coming up in school, they always talked about this brand of Christianity that was taught to the slaves. But my main professor would always call it not Christianity, but he would either call it Americananity or Whiteanity, because it was a derivative of the true Christianity. So they taught the sedatives of the gospel, they taught the slaves in such a way to keep them docile. And so we will see that manipulating of the text, manipulating of religion to help maintain the social structures. So you will see a lot of that going on, not just in America, but in other places. So it's how religion is being interpreted, whether it's Christianity, Islam, you name it. It's how you handle religion, and if you want to justify people being in a particular social context, then you have to interpret that religion in such a way that those people will embrace it and not go against it, but they will cooperate with it.
In the Quran, we're told, stand up for God as witnesses of justice. Mm-hmm. And then there's a second verse that says, stand up for justice as witnesses for God.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be one without the other. Yeah. But we tend to focus often on the imperfections of our fellow human beings, because I can hide my own faults by focusing on someone else's, mm-hmm. rather than on our communal duty for making a better society for everyone.
Yeah.
Part of the rich history of First Baptist Church in Williamsburg is a bell that was acquired in the late 19th century. However, the bell has been inoperable since the days of segregation and Jim Crow. It remains silent through the civil rights movement. Over the past several months, an engineering and conservation team led by experts from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation have restored the bell to working condition. It is now ready to ring once more. The First Baptist Church at Colonial Williamsburg invite everyone in the nation to ring the bell throughout the day, every day for Black History Month. We asked Reverend Davis and others to explain what this bell represents.
Plato once said that a life that goes unexamined
is not worth living. We need to step back and say, am I doing all I can do to help our country? Am I doing all I can to help my community? Because we can learn how to work together. Democracy demands that we work together.
We come together, especially in regard to what's happening in our country today, to indicate that we are all aware of the burdens and the hurts of others, and that we're willing to step out and lead in terms of the healing process.
The bell was talking, and the bell was telling me, I am going to ring for healing, for justice, and to bring all the people together for the month of February so they can participate in what I have to say.
It's a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of restoration. It's a symbol of unity and peace.
It's a rush. You feel like everyone who's coming here is all standing for the same thing.
Everybody should come. At least check it out and see what it's looking like, yes.
It was very powerful. It was very moving. Just having my hands here is like, wow, you could almost feel them. I guess to say I could feel my ancestors. I could feel my ancestors.
There's something greater than ourselves here. It's a way of life we're talking about, to make it better for everyone that comes to this country and everyone who lives here. All people, everyone.
Now more than ever before, that since this bell has gone unrung since the days of segregation, I think when people grab that rope and ring that bell, they will feel not only connected to the past, but I think that they will feel a connection with making our nation a more perfect union.
It's clear that people are very moved by the experience of simply touching the rope that connects them to the bell and all of the history of the First Baptist Church. Reverend Davis, you are inviting everyone to ring this bell. Tell us why.
Well, we want everyone to ring this bell because we believe that America is a nation that loves freedom, liberty, and justice. We have come a long ways, but we see that the trajectory of our country is going in a different direction, that we feel is not inclusive of all people. It won't heal the nation. And so we are just calling people from every description to come and ring that bell and to make that commitment that they're going to continue to work within their faith communities and other places to help heal our nation and make it a more perfect union.
Amen. We have a caller, Pat, in Norfolk, Virginia. Pat, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I was growing up in the 60s, and what I remember, I mean, I was raised Catholic and never knew any of the spirituals. And I heard the music that was, you know, was used in the marches and all in the 60s, and I wondered how far back did the use of music and the spirituals go in the life of the African American church and its role in the freedom of the slaves.
I can comment. Yes, I think the role of the spiritual goes back into the 18th century, certainly, if not earlier. It's hard to pin down specific dates, as you can imagine, for when people are beginning to sing. But I wanted to point out one very important thing about a spiritual connected with First Baptist Church's history. When they were still meeting in secret, a local citizen, a free person, overheard the soulful prayers, beautiful spirituals that the group was singing in secret. And that moved this person to contribute to the congregation, a meeting place. Okay. And so that role, not only did the spiritual inspire the congregation itself, but had an effect on the larger community.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a scripture in the Bible that says, how can we sing the Lord's songs in a strange land? And they refused to sing. But if you look at the African people in the context of America, they had no choice but to sing, because singing was a way to ward off madness. It was a way to ward off, those things that were coming against them, giving them that sense of transcendence. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that, I feel like a motherless child, mm-hmm. when a person has been snatched away from their, you know, from their mothers or fathers. And so a lot of the spirituals came through those horrific experiences. And so they had to sing to just ward off the self-annihilation, because they didn't see freedom on the horizon anywhere. They had no law on their side. And so this was one way of just singing to give those slaves split moments of transcendence, mm-hmm. that one day we will overcome.
Right. Mm-hmm. Reverend Davis, Annie Lewis wants to know, why did the bell ring silent for so long?
Well, one reason why the bell went silent so long, we had structural problems. It was in our steeple for many years. The structure that held the bell, I think it was just unsafe. And so thank God that CW stepped in and rebuilt those structures, and now we're able to ring that bell again. And it's just a wonderful collaboration to come together, because I think that everybody can see that our nation is in trouble. And so we're just trying to bring everybody back together to ring that bell, to say we're going to make a commitment to put this nation back on the track it should be on.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left. Believe it or not, time has flown by.
Wow.
But I want to ask each of you your thoughts on the role of religion and freedom movements. And Reverend Blaylock, I am going to start with you.
Sure.
Final thought.
I guess in thinking about the role of religion, one of the most powerful experiences that I've had recently was our trip to Birmingham and learning much more again about the Children's Crusade and the Children's Marches in Birmingham, and the fact that, you know, sometimes we forget that the movement in Birmingham and the movement really nationally in a lot of ways was saved by children and youth deciding to march.
Right.
And literally fill up the jails in Birmingham to overflowing. And in speaking of the music, in reading that, these children were packed hundreds into cells that were meant for 20 or 30.
Right.
And one of the ways that they survived that was by singing.
By singing.
And sometimes even the stories are about the fact that the guards started chanting racist things at them, and they would drown them out by singing.
Yes.
And that, you know, and the role that, I think the one word that we've haven't talked about, and I'll stop it after this because we'll give y'all a chance, is hope.
Yes.
Hope is one of the most powerful things that religion grants to oppressed people.
Yes.
That we don't have to be stuck this way.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Who wants to go next? We're running out of time.
Sure, I'll go. For me, I think faith is about coming to terms with who you are and what you're about. And all of our religious organizations and doctrines and teachings give us a standard by which to come to terms with ourselves ourselves against. And I think that matters, because you have to know yourself before you can engage the other.
Exactly.
I think in a meaningful way.
Yes.
And for me, looking at, you know, my religious tradition and the Episcopal Church in general, there are just countless stories of individuals recognizing the need that existed in the world. Dr. King mentioned a beautiful individual, Jonathan Myrick Daniels, who was a seminarian at the Episcopal Divinity School, who heard about Dr. King, saw a speech, immersed himself in the movement, and eventually traveled to Alabama to be part of it. Where through a series of events, he stepped in front of a young African-American child and took a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. King spoke about this young man in his speech that recognized who he was in terms of his role in God's economy, as it were.
Exactly.
Okay. Imam?
Yeah, another thing that's very important, we have today, in today's world, millions of people who are oppressed, who are shut out from justice and from equality and opportunity. And there are a lot of reasons for people to be full of anger and hate and a desire for vengeance. And faith gives you the power to forgive your enemy, to move on toward a future rather than being stuck in fighting a lost battle.
Yes. Okay. And let me say very quickly that the singing in the African-American church, they asked, why is there so much singing in the African-American church? And one Greek preacher said, because it makes Babylon more bearable. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have hope. We have to hope against hopelessness. So it makes Babylon more bearable.
Okay, Rabbi, I think we have...
We're told when we read the Passover Haggadah, when we have when we celebrate Passover, we're told to remember that we were strangers in the land of Egypt, to remember that we experienced slavery.
Yes.
And while that is the specific narrative of the Jewish people, you know, that tells us, remember that we were in those shoes as well. At some point, all of us have been in the shoes of being oppressed. Some aspect of each of us has experienced that. And I think that what I take from my religious teaching is to remember that and to see that I could be right where that other person is. And to go back to the point that was brought up before, to treat the other person the way that I would want to be treated, to see myself in my neighbor and to love them as myself.
Okay, Linda, we have about 2 minutes, so your final thoughts.
For me, religion is important and a key to these freedom movements, because not only can the religious messages of our various faith inspire us to seek that freedom, it also instills courage to fight that battle.
Yes.
And you see that time and again, whether it's the early Christians fighting the Roman Empire or all through history, those kinds of resistance. Not only do you need inspiration, but you need courage. And religion often is the source of that courage.
Okay. Reverend Davis, we have time for a very quick final thought from you.
Well, I just want to encourage all Americans to come to First Baptist Church. Go to letfreedomringchallenge.org, sign up, bring yourself, your children, your schools, and let's make this nation a more perfect union.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for being here today. And that is all the time we have. Thank you for joining me for this special edition of Another View, Let Freedom Ring, a co-production of WHRV-FM and the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. I'd also like to thank Reverend Reginald Davis, Linda Rowe, Imam Amar Aminet, Rabbi David Katz, Reverend Max Blaylock, and Reverend Christopher Epperson. If you'd like to proclaim your belief in freedom and equality, please reserve time to ring the bell at the First Baptist Church in Williamsburg. The Colonial Williamsburg Foundation invites you to commemorate Black History Month by participating in the many programs and activities scheduled throughout the month of February. And I hope you will join Barbara Hambly every Friday at noon on 89.5 WHRV-FM for Another View, where we discuss the issues and celebrate the successes of the African-American community. I'm Lisa Godley for WHRV-FM and the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. Have a great week.